Welcome to the sixth podcast of Year of Wonders. We're going to try and finish off as many of the chapters as we can in this podcast so that we can move on to looking at some other things further on down the track. Okay, so we're going to be looking at chapter 11 to start with, The Press of Their Ghosts. At the end of the last chapter, we find out that Aphra has buried Joss in a cairn, which is like a pile of rocks to mark his grave. And that afternoon of the same day, Anna is at the rectory and she's trying to boil tea for Eleanor. And Eleanor comes in and Anna kind of recounts the history of her father and the terrible kind of upbringing that he had, the stories of when he was a child at sea, how he was beaten, how he was abused by the men, and how he never was really able to kind of free himself from the fear that he would actually be dragged back into a gang to work on the ships at sea. So there's an element of balancing out why he was the person that he was, why he drank so much, why he behaved the way he did to the people around him that he supposedly loved. And Anna actually says on page 210, "At the finish of it, I felt free of him and was able to think calmly once more." So she's able to find some measure of inner peace when she's thinking about him. She doesn't forgive him, but she also doesn't hold the same kind of emotional investment that she had before. They move on to talking about Aphra's behaviours and the whole idea of Aphra being superstitious, and the Eleanor kind of reveals the spells that supposedly the witch or the ghost of Annis Gowdy has been sort of selling to the simple folk of Eme. Anna tells Eleanor about Kate Talbot's abracadabra charm earlier on in the book, and that they both decide that Michael needs to be told about what's going on. Now, they go to the Mowbray's cottage, and both are pretty simple kind of people, and there's another sort of story about how this witch or this ghost of Annis Gowdy is sort of fleecing them for money and charms that supposedly protect children from the plague. So it's interesting here in this chapter also on page 214, what she does is she tells Lottie Mowbray how she can actually heal the cuts and the inflammations on her child's body, and says to her, "That's all we can do against this plague, that, and pray to God for deliverance, for it will not come from Satan or for those who work in his shadow." And by the end of this chapter, what Anna's doing is she's able to separate out the idea of the fact that the plague is some sort of natural disease as opposed to a religious or divine kind of punishment from God. And she says here on page 215, "Yes, I would have inclined to believe God's hand at work if, as a result of the rock, I'd struck my head and now lay fatally injured. So where exactly in the design of the world did I believe that matters tilted the scale sufficient to garner God's notice? If I did not think he cared for the lie of a rock, why should I believe he cared for a small life such as mine? It came to me then that we, all of us, spend a very great deal of time pondering these questions that in the end we could not answer. If we balance the time we spent contemplating God and why he afflicted us with more thought as to how the plague had spread and poisoned our blood, then we might come nearer to saving our lives." What Anna does is she realizes that if they work with nature to eradicate the disease, they're probably going to have more success than if they are sitting in a church or in some sort of religious congregation contemplating why they've actually been afflicted by this disease. It's an important turning point for her, and also a step closer to her becoming the healer and the doctor that she actually ends up becoming at the end of the novel. Okay, then she moves on. She moves on, and so we get into the springtime of 1665. And again, the idea of the apples comes up. There are new shoots coming through. You've got the lambing and her anger at the fact that almost as though life goes on and the innocence and the stupidity of these lambs sort of running around and being idiots, basically. There are more deaths that happen as a result of the warmer weather. And so the village now, she says, has more people, has as many people below ground, so buried, as there are above ground. People are starting to get afraid. So the fervor that originally carried them through in terms of that righteousness, yes, we're doing the right thing that Michael gave them at the start, has now started to kind of wear off and people are afraid of each other. The village itself economically is suffering because there are have been so many deaths that the skills that the village had in order to survive are actually being depleted massively. And people are starting to react in different ways with this fear. So you've got Jane Martin, who was this very strict Puritan kind of girl who had, you know, remained very sort of tightly controlled, very assured, and she looked after her family, all of a sudden turns into this absolute loose woman, for lack of a better word. And Anna says, one evening when I came upon her weaving an uncertain way home in the dark, I took her into my cottage, thinking to get her warm and sober in a safe bed and speak some sense to her in the morning. I fed her some stew of mutton neck, but she quickly brought the whole of it up again and was still so wretchedly ill the next morning. I don't believe she heard much of anything I tried to say to her. And then you get somebody on the other extreme of the fear scale in the form of John Gordon, who is physically purging himself. It's almost as though he's actually stripping the flesh and the muscle and as much of himself away from his physical being as possible. And he's, it's as like a self-flagellation that he's actually sort of employing as well as a way of purifying himself. On page 219, Anna finds him and perceives that he stopped every five paces or so, straightened and raised the scourge to strike himself. One of the spikes was bent crooked like a fish hook, so that where it connected with the skin, it caught and tore away a tiny piece of flesh. And something that the flagellants used to do, and still did at this point in time, as a way of purifying themselves in the Catholic faith. And so Anna is seeing this guy who's actually flagellating himself and causing him to kind of walk around with this mass of scabs and bruises, with fresh blood trickling into the dried tracks of earlier injuries. And she tries to stop him, but he actually pushes her aside as though she's actually not even there. And indeed, she actually names him as being a flagellant on page 220, and that Michael doesn't actually do anything to stop him. He shrugs. Who can say? Gordon is a lettered man. It seems that dangerous ideas may spread on the very wind and seek us out near or far as easily as the seeds of disease have done. Now, Anna doesn't know a whole lot about the flagellants or the history of them, so Eleanor explains it to her. And says, at the time of the Great Black Death, they gathered again, sometimes in very great numbers, passing from town to town, drawing the souls of the troubled to them. Their belief is that by grievous self-punishment, they can allay God's wrath. They see the plague as his discipline for human sin. They are poor souls, yet very dangerous, Mr. Montpellier injected. And so what he's afraid of is that the flagellants will actually, or John Gordon will actually create this hysteria and this kind of buying into a very dangerous kind of set of ideas. But he's distracted, Michael, that is, by the sight of Jane Martin lying by the side of the road. And he kind of directs that anger and suppressed frustration that he feels, arguably, with his relationship with Eleanor, and directs it to Jane. He says, this girl knows well what she does here this night. She is in command of the scriptures as well as I. She has taken the pure vessel of her body and filled it with corruption. She has done this knowingly. She shall be punished. And what he's doing is he's actually really talking also about Eleanor as well. Now, because Jane's actually the daughter of John Gordon, they take her back to the cottage, and Urith, who is John's wife, actually says, no, you can't come in because my husband isn't here. And Michael's like, oh, it's fine. I've got Anna with me. We actually need you to open the door. They go inside and they see a cottage that has been completely and utterly taken stripped from any kind of creature comfort. He has, John, that is, has told his wife that she has been required to fast on a cup of broth and a heel of bread a day for the last fortnight. So he's punishing her as much as he's punishing himself. She's afraid of her husband and asks that they don't say anything to him. And he's in his own way, he's sort of losing the plot in the same way that Aphra loses the plot later on. On page 225, she says, "He said you should rather be leading us in public confessions of each and every sin that any one of us has ever committed, so as we might come upon the transgression that has brought down God's wrath and rooted out amongst us. It is not enough, he says, to search our soul, but we must scourge our flesh also. He began a fast, and it has become increasingly severe. Then he burned all our bed straw and insisted we sleep on the bare stones." She coloured a little and went on in a whisper, "By no means were we to take any comfort of each other's bodies, but lie always chaste." So he's getting more and more of a control freak and more desperate to actually provide penance and atonement for the sin that apparently they have committed, in the hope that actually it will stop the plague from continuing. So when they go out looking for Gordon, Michael doesn't find him that night, but finds him a week later when they come across the body of John Gordon, who's been lying at the bottom of the edge for the last week. And there's no way basically of burying him or getting a hold of his body, so they leave him there. They do preach a memorial for him outside at the Delph the following Sunday. And even though the wife, Urith, is there, she actually dies from the plague the following week. So it's just a double blow, basically, for the family. And unfortunately for Michael, the whole flagellation punishment thing seems to have kind of taken off in the village. So Martin Miller makes sure that his family clothes themselves in sackcloth and gets the scourge, which is that whip with the hook on the end of it, or hooks. Randall Daniel does the same thing. And the two of them kind of join together and go around the village saying, you know, you should join us as to and keep doing what we're doing, because, you know, clearly this is something that could work. Now, Michael's trying to communicate with the outside world as well. So he's talking to Mr. Holbrook, who is the rector of another village nearby. And it seems to be something that it's a plan that he's trying to put into motion in order to get some help from the outside world. And there's an insight into the relationship between Eleanor and Michael at the end of this chapter. And it is an insight that makes Anna really quite jealous, because she has a glimpse of the intimacy, she says. And she kind of feels as though it's really unfair that they have each other and she doesn't have anybody. And yet I was jealous of her too, jealous that she was loved by a man as a woman is meant to be loved. Why should I writhe on my cold and empty bed while she took comfort in his warm flesh? And so what she doesn't realise, obviously, until later on, is that Eleanor's not getting too much more comfort than she is from Michael in the bedroom either. And she, as a way of kind of expressing her frustration and anger, she goes into the kitchen and takes the delicate dishes, first his and then hers, and smash them one by one against the unyielding stone, just as a way of kind of releasing a little bit of anger about the relationship and the fact that she doesn't have anyone. Okay, so the next chapter is A Great Burning, and this is where Eleanor gets sick. And the first thought, clearly and obviously, is that she's actually started to contract the plague. Anna wants to tell Michael that Eleanor's getting sick, and Eleanor is, stop this at once, you shall do no such thing. I perceive I am perhaps coming down with a slight cold, and I will not have you fuss and panic me so. I beg you will strive to command yourself. You are not a child to quail at shadows, after all we have seen and done together. If I am truly ill, you will be the first person I shall confide in. Until then, do you not dare to trouble Mr. Montpelier with this. And so Anna's hands are tied, because her loyalty is essentially to Eleanor, and there's absolutely no way that she wants the beans being spilt about her illness. But the problem is, when she coughs into the little white handkerchief, crumples the handkerchief and shoves it away from Anna's gaze. So you can pretty much be assured that there's some sort of blood on there, and as a result, Anna said, "That told me all. I wept then in earnest, standing right there in the middle of the field." Okay, so what you want to keep in mind is with this chapter is the interpretation that Anna has of the relationship between Eleanor and Michael once Eleanor's sick, and then she recovers from the sickness. Anna becomes increasingly jealous of the relationship between the two and the closeness, and she feels excluded and reminded also of how alone she is and not having anybody of her own. So Eleanor recovers, and Michael then suggests that as some sort of divine inspiration that's come to him, that what they should do is actually burn everything, and this will get rid of, it will be the final purifying kind of process in getting rid of the plague. And what it's doing also is echoing what's happening in London as well in the same year. Although the contrast with London is that while it was an accident, in the village they're actually doing it deliberately. And it has Puritan overtones, this action, kind of doing away with everything. And people are just down to the absolute essentials. So, I mean, not that they have much to start with, but they're actually now down to literally the bare bones, pretty much. Now, Brand, when they're burning all of this collective kind of stuff that they have in the village, Brand actually brings Aphra to the burning and exposes her for the fraud that she is, in terms of selling charms and potions and spells to the villagers who have been naive enough to think that something like that would actually work. And the mob turns on Aphra in the same way that they did with Mem and Aniscaldi earlier on. The punishment that they inflict on Aphra was actually really severe, being forced into the manure pit, the pig's manure pit sewer. It was just so literally she's in this manure pit overnight, desperately trying to keep her head above the level of the manure so that she doesn't, as Anna says, if she'd lost consciousness for a second, she would have actually dropped her head and drowned in this slurry, which is gross to think about. And we get a clear sense of Anna's sense of justice in this chapter as well, because she separates herself from the other villagers. And the traditional means, she kind of recaps on what those traditional methods of punishment are at this point in time, and kind of distances herself with agreeing that sometimes, with these other people, that sometimes the punishment outweighs the actual crime. Aphra's loss of sanity as a result of this is clear to see. It's kind of like this is the final straw for her. She has lost her husband, who was accused of theft. She has lost her sons, and she's left with Faith, her 3-year-old daughter. And even though they help the Montpellians and Anna help her back to her cottage after she's sort of rescued, and the shame of what they've done is visited on the men that actually put her in the pit to start with. Both Anna and Eleanor, she refuses to have anything to do with. She accuses Anna of becoming Eleanor's creature, and she wants nothing more to do with either of them. Faith, the daughter, hasn't actually spoken ever. Anna's never heard her speak, and she keeps this sort of silent vigil. When Anna comes up, she's dropping off potions, food, trying to make amends in some way, I suppose, and to make sure that Faith is looked after as well. On the third day, she doesn't actually see Faith watching her, and it turns out that she's actually contracted the disease and Faith has died. And in one of the more kind of supernatural aspects or incidents in the book, Anna actually sees Aphra performing a spell around the child, and she has her kind of strung up like a puppet, and her face has been painted this chalky white to sort of, in Aphra's madness, to make her look as though she's alive again. And Anna's really afraid of her, and she says, although she doesn't believe in spirits or witchcraft, it definitely, especially with the snake and the imagery and the forked tongue at the end of this passage, what she's doing, Aphra's doing during this ceremony, brings this very much to mind. And she's well and truly gone mad by this point, and is pretty much a lost cause. Okay, now bizarrely, I'm not going to extend this beyond the limits of human patience. I'm going to split this podcast into two. So this is going to be podcast 6A, and then I'm going to actually cover chapter 13, which is deliverance, and apple-picking time, which is 1666 in the next podcast. Okay, so I will catch you then.